Hello and welcome to Pale Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wabo's most wordy work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
I'm going to be sad to say goodbye to Wabo's most wordy work. It's just some really nice alliteration that rolls off your tongue real smooth.
It sounds really fun to say.
Try it, Elliot. Give it a try.
Wordy work.
No. You got to say Wabo's most wordy work. The W on Wabo starts to kind of set it up.
So where we reflect on Wabo's most wordy work as a release.
Yeah, see? I'm Ruben Morehouse. It feels good. I encourage everyone who's listening live in the Discord or just listening to the podcast to give it a try now. It's quite fun. Shall we talk about these chapters? I guess we don't know that this is the last chapter of this arc, but it seems pretty likely.
I actually think the opposite. I'm going to be extremely surprised if it's not 16.z this weekend.
Oh, really?
Because Pale has been super consistent about having .z for the end interludes, and this one was .y.
It was, yes.
So unless there's some really big reason that I'm missing as to why this one was a Y that felt right in the chapter, it seems like we'll get one more.
I have long since given up on trying to interpret what letter the interlude means, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you're right that there's not like a hard set in stone thing, but like Wabo's generally consistent-ish with the, like, he's pretty consistent. I feel like a dot Y is sending a message.
All right, we'll see. Which means this might not be our last Wabo's most wordy work, but
yeah.
Yeah, let's get into it. Left in the Dust 1610, shall we?
I do just want to say the one time Wabo stuffed up the interlude naming was when he forgot that he'd already written 12.a when he had the Witch Hunter interlude.
Yeah, of course. I knew you were going to bring that up. It wasn't 12.a, Elliot, by the way. It was 12a.
No, the Witch Hunter one was 12.a, and that was a mistake. Yes. It should have been 12.b.
But then that really would have broken the system because it wasn't 12.a, it was 12a. So the interludes for that chapter should have just been, if what you're saying is true and not just nonsense, which it is, that the interlude chapter should have been all for that chapter, 12b.
No, because it is 12.a, but it was called 12a because it's cherry pop, but it still like is for what counts.
Oh, 12.a. I see. It doesn't have to literally. 12.a, but cherry pop just messed up like typing it into WordPress or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. The obvious answer to that, as it says, is 12A was an interlude, not an interlude.
Yeah, but I have the same defense for the difference there.
Anyway, I think we could talk about this forever.
I will die on this hill.
I think, yes, eventually you will, Elliot. but let's talk about 16.10, which is Verona's chapter here, the continuation of the domain chapter, or the conclusion of the domain ritual, I suppose. Verona gets ready for what the judges throw at her and starts kind of preemptively defending the decision for the third Kenna and what it's meant to be, trying to get out ahead of whatever it is that the judges are planning.
Which I really like that sort of, she's like, okay, they're coming. I'm just going to like start laying down some ground, which is really good because that ends up kind of being what they wanted to do. Like she's once again spot on. And I really like her framing here of like, oh, Lost Kennet is very specifically the magic of this world.
Mm.
Because I think it's very easy to view Under Kennet as a magical side to Kennet because it's like literally an upside down world made by magic. But like as Verona points out, it's like an extremely human place, even though it's of like made by magic or whatever. Like it's made to invert the very human side of Kennet above, and it's drawing specifically from human stuff. And she's really establishing this third one as like inhumanly magical, like the side, the Ken that they couldn't produce is the example she would. And like, so I just had never thought about this third side in that way. And I really, really love this framing for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's good. I love the way that the idea of Verona being Forsworn is introduced in this chapter because it's such a like needle scratch moment of, you'll be Forsworn then, he told her. And we and Verona are both like, hold on, wait, what?
The fuck?
Yeah, it's a, I mean, I think it's a good way to really make sure it hammers home to Verona, because I think if the Sable had said, okay, well, if you fail to do this, then we'll have to force weigh you, Verona would have been like, yeah, whatever, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
Phrasing it like this is a way to make sure she knows, like, hey, this is on the table.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want the Sable as my doctor, though. Like, this is terrible bedside manner, but I suppose that's the point. And that's the Sable, right? He doesn't fuck around.
Yeah, it's real, that doctor from Arrested Development. It's like, yeah, the doctor comes in and says to you, you're going to die. Wait, what? Eventually, as we all are.
Exactly. I mean, the funny thing is, this got me thinking. I actually reckon seeing one of the Kenneteers get forsworn could actually be a really interesting chapter to the story, just because we now have Charles as our big bad and the big enemy.
Yeah.
And just, like, you know, once he gets past the 10 minutes of, like, delivering the biggest I told you so to whoever got forsworn.
I mean, it has to be Verona, right? She's been flirting with it so much. Yeah, yeah. I really had this, in those, like, three sentences between the Sable saying this and expanding more on, you know, it's not a guaranteed forswearing, but a possible one, you know. I really thought to myself, oh, my God, this is so fascinating, like, Verona being forsworn, but maybe she'll be allowed to keep her domain and, like, it'll be some, like, new system. Really feels like a very interesting continuation of themes, right? Like, changing what forswearing means to make it not as terrible is kind of a step towards what Charles wants.
And that's what would be so interesting about this is because, like, Charles is our enemy, but also is so close to not being the enemy. Yeah. And so, like, one of the Kenneteers getting forsworn would be a really interesting way to play with that line, because it would test their ability to figure out how they go, where they go from here, and how much it would help them see the appeal of his side, probably. But then on the other side, it would be a really interesting test of his and his culprit's characters, of, like, how he treats a forsworn now that he's on top. Like,
yes.
Kind of feel like, depressingly, the answer is he just steamrolled them, because if they were trying to get in the way of, you know, his plan, his cause, because he just constantly likes to let me down like that. But I would love to see.
I mean, he's very hypocritical. Yes, he sticks to his morals only seemingly when it benefits him.
Like, I'm easily impressed in the chat is bringing up Seth, which was the exact thought I had of, like, have we heard if he's done anything for Seth?
Yeah, no, he hasn't, right? Seth is being taken care of by Nicolette. Like, explicitly, Nicolette has talked about how she is keeping him afloat.
Still, yeah.
I really like the idea. I hate to say it because I know it would be absolutely devastating to Verona, but I really do narratively like the idea of Verona getting forsworn.
Yeah, I couldn't handle it because it would be too, like, it would take too much from the story for me, like, at the same time. True. Like
it would mean losing Verona's practice, which obviously is wild.
I started trying to think of a character who wasn't a Kenneteer that I'd be, like, okay with this with, and the best I came up with was, I thought it would be funny if it was, like, Zed.
Oh, God, no, I hate that, please.
Just because he's Ray's apprentice, I think the joy of him, of Charles having to interact with Ray in that way, could be fun. But that's
maybe Musa. Maybe a Musa forswearing would be interesting.
No, because then I'd find it really hard to care whether Charles did it the right thing or not.
Yeah,
you know?
maybe it could be somebody like I don't know, Anthem or somebody that's in Musa's crew.
What about Nicolette?
Nicolette is a good pick
because she's been so good to Seth too. Like, that's just, if Charles doesn't give her the time of day,
Raquel. Really, Raquel is a good pick from Mirthstrike. Sorry to interrupt.
No, you're right. Yeah.
There's some interesting predictions being posted in the live discussion thread right now. Yeah, I like Raquel. Mirthstrike,
this is a bad can of worms we've opened.
Yeah, I know.
Which character do you want to see forsworn? Next discussion question.
Yeah. Let's talk about what the judges have decided, though, which is effectively you need to answer this contest now from us. We'll contest it a reasonable amount. And then when you create the third Kennet, you'll also have to answer the contest there. I think that's pretty fair. Verona is pulling some real shenanigans here, and the judge's whole point is to arbitrate shenanigans, and I think they're doing a fair decision. So, yeah.
But, because you're right, like, we probably didn't talk about this enough last week, but she's pulling some, like, real, Cryptoland shit right here with like claiming a place that doesn't yet exist. Like that is a shit thing to do. And she was intentionally pushing the line with it. So I don't know. I'm kind of torn on calling it fair from the judges, because I think the really fair part is them saying, hey, when you bring new Kennet in, you have to redo challenges for that place. Mm-hmm. I think that that's pretty reasonable. What I don't understand is if they're already making her do that, why put her through the shit here today?
That felt to me like it's more about the third Kennet itself than actually the domain, right? Like,
because well, they definitely say it's both. Through,
yeah. Yeah, true, true. I don't know. I guess just as a like, hey, fuck you for trying to pull one over on us.
Honestly, that's the vibe I got, is it's a bit of a punishment for, essentially trying bullshit. Which,
yeah,
I don't know,
which
maybe,
I love.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, as I'm saying that, I'm like, I kind of see their point.
Yeah, it reminds me of when Verona did this, was messing with the Witch Hunter's ability to enter the contest. And was it the Saber who was basically fuck off, stop trying to break the rules or bend the rules.
If anything, this is, and because we'll be talking about this a lot next chapter, this is the system punishing her for trying to push bullshit past.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing as well, like, is I was wondering how much this impacts, like, essentially the entire premise of this domain claim is that they were doing it as a sneak attack while Mus is distracted.
Yeah.
How much is he going to be around for this next round of claims? Like, are they going to have to time? I mean, they'll probably have to, like, time that ritual again too, but I'm just really interested in, like, how much this fucks up Verona's plan to get this done under the radar.
My feeling was with it was that the people who would be able to contest it were like
specifically
the people that
lost.
Would be denizens of the like lost Kennet. So maybe it's not as much of a thing, but possibly, I don't know.
I mean, yeah, so again, I'm just desperate for Marlin to have something to do with lost Kennet. Maybe that's something for her. Also, I don't know, I'm starting to believe all of the things people have been talking about for ages now, like with the wolf potentially showing up, just because
I have a prediction that I want to talk about.
I did see that.
I think it's really interesting.
Just because there's no way Avery's not in town for the weekend when they do the ritual to make lost Kennet. I mean, she's their expert. So if she is in town anyway while Verona has to do this, I'm a bit like, okay, then maybe, the wolf can show up. And also just more Brett in this ritual is obviously what we need. And don't try and tell me Verona's wolf won't look like Brett. I can't remember if it had a dream when they went to if we saw her wolf when we went to the dreams. No, it was Charles's wolf. Yeah, I don't think we've seen her wolf, but it's Brett.
Yeah, we will see. Yeah, I think it's going to be Brett-esque. I don't think the wolf just takes the form of people, but like takes the qualities of them. Yeah.
You know what it'll be? It'll be a Brett who's successful in society. Like somehow it'll be both Brett and representative of like, bureaucracy.
Or a Verona who has gone down the path of becoming Brett. Maybe that's maybe the most horrifying thing I can think of.
So to go back to the judges and their fairness and stuff as well, I do just want to say something we forgot to mention. The Sable does give Verona an out of this at the start, which is actually quite nice. Like he does give her a, listen, these are the terms, but we understand that this is all kind of coming out of left fields because it is. So you can bail if you want. It'll hurt your claim, but like we're not going to stick you with this ultimatum of succeed or be forsworn.
Yeah.
But then again, this leads me into what is the purpose of these challenges here today? Because we'll obviously get into them in a sec, but essentially these tests that the judges give her today all kind of revolve around making sure she's committed and understands what she's doing and why. And it's like, surely doing that after the conditions for the ultimatum of be forsworn or succeed, like, I guess that leans more into them just doing it to be assholes back to her, because like, why would you test her commitment after she's already got forswearing on the hook? Like that's got that sorted. She's committed now.
Yeah, I think it's quite funny that that's the order they chose to do things in. But I do feel like they aren't going to give her tests without giving her the option. You know, like they can't give her the option to back out after they've already started getting involved. them getting involved is spending enough energy that they, you know, that she's committed.
I guess, like, it just leads into, I guess, my confusion about what these tests served purpose-wise, aside from just fucking with Verona and getting bit of direction for Lost Kennet, which they mention.
It's out of order in a funny way, for sure. So, yeah, the first thing that the judges face Verona with is the milkmaid. just having her face the milkmaid and face the horror that is Clara, which is apparently her name.
I love how this devolves very quickly because the milkmaid gets her human name used, and then Verona opens it with like her typically casual self, like Verona's just going, "Hey, you know, do you talk?" And oh, they said you're illustrating something. Can you share? I love art. Like, she's just being so friendly and casual, and Clara just picks up a 2x4, turns it into a shiv, and charges her. It's just like, it's such a great what the fuck escalation moment as we just enter a completely different headspace, which is this slasher horror, boogeyman episode.
Yeah, I love that the purpose of this, canonically from the judges, is just to fuck with Verona and show her how terrifying the milkmaid is, because the point of this is, you know, to demonstrate what Toadswallow's hands are, you know, unclean by his association with this horrible creature. So really what the judges are just trying to do here is fuck Verona up.
There's a reference to Alpi at the start of this where they're like, oh, Alpi would have come and told you soon. And I was like, yeah, speaking of Alpi, you guys need to go to whatever class she needs to go to for chilling the fuck out with these visions. Because, like, they dump her in a pile of gelatinous corpses to make their point. That doesn't seem necessary.
Not necessary, but, you know,
fun.
Part of demonstrating how scary this stuff is. And, yeah, I'm sure they just want to kind of fuck with Verona a bit. If I was a judge, Verona's the exact kind of practitioner that pushes the, you know, blurs the lines enough that I'm like, all right, you know, I'm just going to fuck with you when I can.
Yeah, it's like that thing Zed was saying in, like, Arc 13, I think it was, or maybe late Arc 12, where he was like, most practitioners will maybe get to see one of the judges at, like, the climax of their journey. Whereas these three just meet up with them all the time. Like, you know, so I think the fact that these three judges showed up for a domain claim is actually super weird. So, yeah, there probably is a sense of, like, this fucking girl again.
Like, yeah, why is it always these ones, huh? Yeah.
I like that escalation from, like, you mentioned how this is really about showing how bloody Toadswallow's hands are by association. Yeah. And I like how that takes a while to sort of really come up, because at first it's just the violence, and you're right, that really lets you feel how terrible the milkmaid is, makes their point unnecessarily strongly. And I really like the extra detail that the traps that were in the milkmaid's basement are what Verona weaponizes to use as part of her escape. So it's kind of like the thing that got Verona out of here, and like the thing that hurt the milkmaid was the stuff Toadswallow gave to her. It's just that extra salt on the wound of, yeah, Toadswallow is arming her. Because we saw firsthand how effective those are as weapons in anyone's hands, let alone the milkmaid's.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. The reflectiveness of this scene in that way, where they're both just, Toadswallow's just kind of arming both sides of this conflict.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we go through and see kind of a montage after this of the Kennet Council at their most evil moments to demonstrate to Verona what this third Kennet will be built off of the back of.
And so I know that we're meant to be, like, upset and, you know, horrified by what we're seeing here for Verona. I think we actually knew most of this stuff.
Yes.
But I couldn't help but just, this is so cool, like,
yeah, I love
Verona.
It's so fun.
Shifting through visions of like John shooting a guy, and then as somebody else like pleads for his life in a different language, gets shot, and then you cut to like Pekka's not suffocating. I was like, if this was a moment where I was like, I know this is meant to be traumatic, but if you asked me to pick like 1 minute of Pale to get turned into an animation, this would be one of the lead candidates already.
Yeah, it's very compelling.
Yeah, it's just, and like visually, just the idea of like Verona being cycled through and reacting to just these different horrors of all these people we know and love. I was like, yeah, honestly, like, I guess we'll get there later in the episode. This is a good discussion question ideas. Like, if you had to pick one, like a minute of a Pale to get animated, like what would it be?
Put it in the notes for next week's episode for sure before we forget about it. Yeah, I really loved this section. I really loved Rook's part especially.
Yeah.
Rook is just such a fucking fun character. Again, I know it's meant to be horrifying, et cetera, et cetera. Let's get past that because I really enjoyed this exchange between Rook and this girl that she had basically condemned to death.
Yeah, and especially because this is like a great little example of how like violence and war and stuff takes the God, I wish I had a better word than humanity to say it takes you the humanity out of people, because specifically in this example, it's not the right word. Because what I love is like there's this moment where Rook tells the girl, oh, if you want to survive, learn how to hunt. And then the girl's like, couldn't you just give us two goats? And Rook's like, no, if we give you two goats, then we might starve. And it's like, well, couldn't you hunt? Like, just, you know, like, but like, I mean, on the other side of things, Rook actually suggests, oh, I could turn you into an other that can hunt to feed for your entire town. And this girl just is straight up like disgusted by it. So there's this moment where I'm like, okay, I mean, you know, this girl is the, you know, she's otherist. I can understand Rook's lack of sympathy.
Yeah, but also Rook did just like murder her whole tribe, right?
Yeah, well, and you know, we'll be talking about this a lot next chapter too, but this is that whole thing with like a war like this is you otherize the enemy.
Yeah, yeah.
Heartless evil acts tend to propagate, I guess.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, great stuff. Liz's inclusion here was very interesting as well. Like, the Doe rightly points out that Liz has basically given the house on Half Street to Verona, which is a great point and really reaffirms, like, Liz is obviously going to be a key factor in what Sideways Kennet looks like. So I think it's, I think it's a really great point for the Doe to point out, like, no, Liz is a major part of this and you need to accept that.
Yeah, because I definitely hadn't really thought about it enough. Like, if it is part of Kennet, which is what they're setting up, it will be a part of her too. And similar to how she's shaped the underside of Kennet, we assume a lot, her influence on Sideways Kennet will be pretty important. And I just, again, we need to get them more FaceTime with Liz. They didn't talk to her anywhere near enough in that last meeting.
Yeah.
I have a bit of a soft spot for her as far as the culprits go, because she's like, she feels more redeemable than Charles, Mariska, or Edith to me. Like, Liz is somebody who kind of got brought in and they promised her a lot, and she said she was convinced Charles's plan would work and Mrs. wouldn't. But it all happened in such a way where I'm like, there's still a version of the events from her perspective where I can see her being salvageable.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely more so, at least, than the other three.
Yeah, we know enough about the other three for me to kind of write them off at this point. But yeah, like, Liz is definitely, there's a version of the events where she's gotten to where she has been, and I can still see her being able to get talked down or at least talked more onto their side.
Yeah, we will have to see if that ends up happening, but I agree.
Yeah. And yeah, like, I guess because that's going to be, I kind of thought that was what this arc was going to be at the start, but I guess now it's probably next arc. But yeah, like, obviously the big thing that the Alabaster brings up here is, like, you know, Verona and stuff have to kind of start really defining what they want Sideways Kennet to be. And we're getting confirmations from Verona here. The Liz is obviously now a factor, and it's just going to be so interesting to sort of see what, I think they said they had to get 77 items. It's like, how do you put those 77 together in a way that sends a message about what it's going to be?
Yeah. I don't know. It's complex stuff. I'm assuming this is what is going to come up next arc, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So, yeah, the judges kind of present more challenges and questions to her, kind of asking what she wants the Domain and Third Kennet to be, And Brett shows up to help hit some of these questions home, I suppose.
Before we get to House Brett, I do just want to say how much I fucking love this statement Verona gives sort of right at the start here, like where she addresses the Alabaster's the end of the Alabaster segment is basically her saying, I have darkness in me, but I'm not going to embrace it. I can like fight in the darkness, but I'm not going to choose to fight. I want to be somebody who understands it and can get in there, but to unravel it. And it just feels like, that's just exactly in line with how I'd like to think of things as well. But like, it's just so perfect for Verona as like a culmination or a next step in this journey she's been going through of having that practitionery Alexandery side to her and trying to decide how she can have part of that but still be like on the good side. Like we've seen people like Jess kind of be concerned of Verona because there's that potential in her to turn into an Alexander, and this is her really saying there is a way for me to do good while having that side of me. And I just love the way she put that together.
I agree. I think the thing that I liked the most about this section was it feels like Verona really has grown through this conversation with House Brett, right? Like,
yeah,
these are things that I have been worried about for Verona, and I think these are things that she didn't necessarily really have the ability to articulate before being challenged by something that clearly is her, like being challenged by herself to grow and define herself in a way that is more positive, right? And I think that's a really great representation of like the positive strengths of a domain is an opportunity to reflect and improve.
I mean, exactly. It's so good. She has a number of these moments because we just talked about that one where she sort of is defining how she can reconcile having the darkness in her as well. And later on, she's going to get to addressing the concerns around her ability to commit to things and like maintain relationships. And it's like, of course, it has felt to me for a while like Verona has just been like really frustratingly not making progress. Like she's kind of moved laterally a lot, but I've been like for quite a while now, I've been like, come on, Verona, like please move forward. And of course it had to happen during this like ritual because she's complained about her lack of raw power for so long, and she's meant to get a power boost by having a domain. So of course those two things coincide, and she finally has these moments of growth in her character as she's presumably also getting just a raw power boost because it's the other verse, and those things come hand in hand. Like we saw that with Lucy and her implement ritual in Arc 6. It was one of those moments of, you're right, like Verona has a number of times during this chapter where she finally says something that I feel like I've been begging for her to address for like 6 arcs, and it's like, oh, of course it had to happen in this chapter.
Yeah, I think it's very cool. It's very cool. I love these rituals. They're so fun. I love it. Obviously, it's great that Brett's here. Like, it all ties together so well. It's a low blow from the house taking Brett's form, but I guess needing to force Verona to have some introspection, maybe it's the right move.
It did seem unnecessarily cruel, but I guess that is my summary of this entire round from the judges. They don't play around.
Was this the judges, or was this Verona's part of Verona's self kind of identifying that this needs to be done to make sure that you can kind of get through to her? I don't know.
That's a good point. I mean, either way, that, you know, the judges again could have not done it like this. This was almost a section where I think this worked a lot better for me on a second read. Like when you know that Brett is kind of a manifestation of the house or the domain. To the point where I almost wish that it had just been told to us the first time, because this conversation flows so great on your second pass. Like the way House Brett moves from topic to topic and criticism to criticism made a lot more sense to me the second time, as you're like, oh, it's worried about being abandoned and it's worried about her, you know, not doing this. And it's such a great conversation. I think if you're like me and the first time you weren't really sure what was happening and you're just too excited to really pay attention, go read it again because it flows fantastically the second time.
Yeah, it's good stuff, definitely. With that step complete, Verona needs to next weather the storm of echoes of previous owners And she does okay. She's never been great at managing her emotions, but she does okay here before a few more no contests from the periphery of the Kennet others kind of swing by.
Yeah, I mean, we get the first delivery on these moments of growth from Verona as she finally admits that, hey, maybe she's bad at echoes, actually. It's like an immediate sign of growth and better perspective right there that she can, like, I mean, this is something I think we've been saying for arcs now, is like Verona's always like, I'm immune to echoes. And it's always like, are you though? and this is her finally saying, oh, but yeah, just again, like, this sort of self-perspective that has eluded Verona at times in the past. I don't think it's an accident that she immediately has this thought after, you know, having all these grand thoughts about her life and her purpose just in the section above.
Yeah, it really resonates that this is her becoming more aware of her own flaws in a tangible and interesting and exciting way.
Yeah, and I think something that jumped out to me as we were like writing the notes for this section is how great it is that, like, because yeah, as I said, this has been the thing for Verona that I felt like she's been frustratingly unable to grow on. Like she sort of gets these human problems and finds ways around them rather than like actually thinking, what do I want? Like, who am I as a person, and like growing in that way. And she's getting a lot better at that now. And I just love that she's been bad at that, because I never thought about, like, she's never thought about the core fundamentals of who she wants to be.
Mm.
And I love that because core fundamentals are kind of her whole thing in, like, the practice.
Mm.
So, like, if you think about it, the core fundamentals of who she is as a person, that's some Kennet above fundamentals. That's, you know, that's yes, lowest priority true. For her.
Yeah.
And this is the ritual getting to her to the point where even though they're the lowest priority, she can raise them up and get them done.
Yeah, that's a really good call. We get to see Monty and Sig come by in no contest, and they're very fun to interact with. I know we kind of had Sig has really had his time in the sun, but I do want more Sig time.
Oh, I see. If we had to pick one, I'd vote Monty, I reckon. He's just so...
Nah, I'd pick Sig for sure. Sig's so cool.
I mean, they both are.
True.
Also, I mean, we got to give a shout out to Chloe. She just continues to be this ray of positivity. Like, she just comes and gives, like, cleaning vouchers because it's part of a scam to get Verona to hire her more often. That's great.
It's good stuff.
I also love the moment, sorry, as we're, like, going through all of the Kennet above people just coming in no contesting, each of them, like, gets added to the mural, and... there's this great moment where Verona sort of makes a comment about how she needs more male friends, or this place is just going to end up covered in pictures of naked women. And then Tashlet does this like miming, and then Verona comments on like, oh, well, that would just ruin the aesthetic. And it's like, it's not till Verona makes that comment that you can like be like, oh, Tashlet was saying, couldn't they just not be naked? And I just love how Wildbo's able to create moments like that with all of these characters who have very different forms of communication. Like, it's the same with like Sig and Monty from before. Like,
yeah,
just so much fun.
It's very natural in a very fun way, isn't it?
Yeah. And it works like great from a reading thing, because you see Tashlet mimed and you're like, oh, wait, what is she saying? Huh? I don't understand. Yeah. And then you get to like put the puzzle together yourself. It's fun.
Yeah. So, the goblins show up and no contest. And Verona takes this opportunity to chat. Sorry,
eventually,
it takes a bit of, you know. But Verona takes this opportunity to confront Toady about what she's seen, basically.
And before we get into that, I do just need to call out that Verona gets a bottle of tequila from Biscuit, which I don't know if that counts as a gift or a challenge.
Yeah.
I do love how Lucy's like, Ronnie, do not drink that tequila. And Biscuit's like, drink it. I just love that Biscuit has made drugging people against their will funny.
Oh, goblins. Love them. goblins have never done anything bad, no matter what next chapter might try and convince you.
Propaganda, that on.
Yep. It's good stuff, definitely.
To get to the Toad Swallow thing you brought up. She challenges him on all the shit he's done in his past. And same with Miss, I really respect how the two of them take these accusations, yeah. and are like, yes,
except
you're not wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it feels like the best way to handle it that I can think of to sort of say, yeah, I fucked up and I realize now, like, especially Miss is sort of like, yeah, that was a bad call. I shouldn't have done that. And I want to do better, which is like, you can't really ask for more than that.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, they're not saying, oh, maybe the judges just don't speak perfect English.
Yeah, it's they completely accept what they've done is wrong and accept the consequences.
Yeah, Totsuro doesn't even really challenge her calling a revote on his leadership. Like, I really respect that. That for me, that was one of those, like, oh, he passed the Bristow test moments. Like, he understands that his hands aren't clean, and he knows that as he's trying to build a better world, that means he needs to be better too. And yeah, so he's willing to put someone else in charge if everyone thinks they're better. And it's just, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, yeah. I'd vote for him because of the way he handled this challenge.
Yes, 100%. Now, here's something that we really need, Elliot. Is fan art of this completed mural. Because when I read what Toad Swallow's thing on the mural was, which is a little goblin-y figure kind of atlas-like holding open the mouth of a frog who is trying to eat them, it's just so fucking good. We just need the fan art of the entire mural.
The thing about the mural, though, is parts of it are, like, off the walls, I think, and it's also in a room. Like, what you need, we need...
like a 3D explorable space.
I was gonna say, yeah, like Tilt Brush in VR would be a great thing. Like I play in Tilt Brush semi regularly, but I'm too bad at art to do this. But that would be like, if we get Tilt Brush in the hands of one of the fan artists, I reckon they could do real justice to this.
Yeah, I just want to see it. I think it's awesome. But yeah, so we get the final challenger, Anthem Ted, who is here to get revenge for Liberty being upset after leaving Avery's house.
Yet another fantastic oh shit moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I was just going to say, I really thought Anthem was the person Avery had gone to fight. I think I said that in last week's episode. I was like, oh, Avery's gone to fight Anthem. So he was almost literally the last person I expected to show up here. And it just floored me.
Yeah, it was very, very fun. I really liked Anthem's vibe in this chapter, huh? Like, he really wasn't here to... It didn't feel like he was here for muscle. It felt like he was here for Liberty in a very tangible way, which I thought was interesting. Like, he gave me, like, defending his daughter's honor vibes, which is kind of, you know, a bit old school, but I kind of liked how he was acting. I don't know.
Yeah, Anthem is... continuing to grow into one of the characters I'm the most fascinated by, because I love him as much as I hate him. Like, I despise everything he stands for, but also not. You're right. Like, the vibe here, he's just here for Liberty and he listens to America, but then also, like, you know, he's best mates with Musa, so he's clearly like a dick, but you can't help but kind of admire him, even though his goodwill is so very localized to two people.
Yeah.
Like, he's and I definitely know people like this in real life, people who are very kind to, like, their family or whatever, but then just, like, you know, dickheads to waiters or whatever. Like, actually very shit people, but the people in their life think they're a lot nicer than they are because they're nice to people in their lives. I mean, I don't get the vibe that Anthem's one of those people who's like, Liberty and America are my daughters, so they're an extension of me, so it's my legacy I'm protecting. I get the vibe that he genuinely, in his way, cares about them.
Yes.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. I mean, obviously, America has now been captured by people working with Avery, so that will be interesting.
Yes, I know. What? Anthem it's response. So funny that I saw some people thinking about whether the America that is on the phone in this chapter actually is America, depending on the timeline of the next chapter. But it seems like that doesn't quite add up. America just helps them out here and then gets abducted by fucking Basil in, you know, Bridge in the next chapter.
I
just goes to show, don't help a Kenneteer.
Yeah. There's a chance that America was in Basil's cabin when she took that phone call, and maybe that's why she was extra pissed at Avery. But I'm more inclined to believe that you're right. It's before she ran into Avery. Yeah, you're right. Never trust a Kenneteer.
Never trust a Kenneteer.
Sorry, somebody in the chat, I'm easily impressed, has asked, who's a better dad, Anthem or Ray? I really like that question because they're like opposites. Like, Ray was far too focused on the big picture and didn't give his son like enough personal time, whereas Anthem's kind of the opposite. He's so obsessed with his daughter as people that he's not letting them have their own freedom in a way.
Mm. Yeah, I think Ray is probably a better parent figure now, but, you know, probably wasn't at some point.
Yeah, and then the other thing to bring up, so Anthem leaves, but he does heavily imply she's going to lose the domain as this goes on.
Mm.
Now, my understanding of the domain sitch is that they're pretty permanent.
Yes.
So even if Musa, like, takes this area and becomes, like, the mega superlord.
The superlord, yeah.
I don't think that he can undo domains.
No, I don't think so either. I think it's more just like, enjoy your domain while this area is friendly to you, because it's not going to be forever.
Oh, see, I read it as either a threat that they'll kill her to get rid of the domain, or that Musa will have someone take it from her.
Mm. True, that could be something that Musa could do. I mean, that's kind of his whole vibe is stealing influence. Maybe he can also do that with domains.
Oh, he owns like 6 domains. He talked about it when he was here.
I'm sure that's something that he'll do then. Try and steal a domain. Why not?
I mean, he's very selective about what he takes, but also he does need to train up whoever Reed. He can give it to
Raquel or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, whoever's replacing Reed, because he gave Reed like the stuff that wasn't quite good enough for him. So, and like, this is a pretty swish domain, like with you know, it's sort of a grounding in 3 planes. I can see the appeal. So yeah, I reckon it's good odds that somebody from the Musa camp is going to show up to take it at some point.
What if Musa takes it? What if Musa takes it and then the Kenneteers don't make the 3rd Kennet? Would Musa be the one who gets forsworn? I wonder.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. But it's be like a funny way to deal with him, huh?
Yeah. Wait, but it's more of a loan when they took it from memory, so I feel like it'd still be Verona on the hook. He'd just lose the domain, which for Musa would be like, oh, well, that was annoying.
Yeah, no, I agree. It probably is not the case, but I think that would be pretty It would have
been
funny.
A fun gotcha.
Yeah. So, yeah, Verona has her domain and goes to take a walk with Lucy while they let it settle a bit. And, yeah, we get the ending to this chapter where Anthem reveals, hey, you know, GG, it's over, basically. Musa's got Toronto and the surrounding areas, so good luck.
Yeah, which, you know, I'm not super up to date on Ontario or exactly the judge's bounds, but yeah, I'm very much of the impression that if they've got Toronto, like, that's like getting Sydney here. Like, Sydney has like 70% of our state's population or something. So it's like,
yeah.
If you owned Sydney, taking the rest of New South Wales would be a walk in the park, relatively.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it definitely, I got the vibes. It's like, okay, he's got Toronto. Everything else is just like, you know, just a matter of time.
Yeah, that's the vibe I got as well. And that's where we leave this chapter. Shall we get into the next one? 16.Y, Millie Legendre.
What a fun girl. Just having a good time. No stress.
No stress, all wine and cheese. Yeah, so we're back in time. Hugh Legendre is taking his daughter to deal with some goblins, and he doesn't merely coddle her. It's a series of horrific murders. So Hugh dispatches the goblins with minimal collateral damage.
Yeah, Millie cops like a small beating, but, you know, he saved her life, so it was probably worth it.
Yeah,
practitioner take your daughter to work day doesn't seem like a fun vibe, does it?
No, it definitely doesn't. Hey, can I call out something funny, which I noticed was when they start, somebody else who is there says, he brought a kid, and then he's like, bait, and her dad's like, not funny, the house is clear, which I thought was hilarious, given that she does kind of end up being bait to reveal the final few goblins that are in the house. Now, I don't think it's intentional from you, but God, how fucking funny would it be if it was?
I mean, surely not even most of the practitioners we've seen in this story are terrible enough to use their own kids as bait. Like, you'd have to be a special kind of fucked up.
We learn in this exact chapter that Hugh is not above giving up young family members for his own means.
Good point. Actually, you're right. He doesn't say no. Yeah. He says not funny.
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, like, I don't think it's intentional, but I do think it's fucking hilarious. The possibility is wide open for it.
Yeah. No, you're right. I think it wasn't the... I think it's one of those practitioner things where he's like, that's not the reason I brought her, but, you know, it's a thing where if it happens, then, you know, it's nice.
Yeah.
But I also, I just really love this as, like, an opening because... So we learnt last chapter from Verona that boogeymen are like slasher villains, like, you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street brought to life sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then we see some pretty horrific goblins in this chapter.
Yes.
That feel like they're not that far off that niche. I was like, I can see why.
Stuff.
Yeah, I can see why some of the first non-goblins in this market were a pair of boogeymen because... The worst of goblins doesn't seem to be that different from, you know, boogeymen.
Yeah, which I think is especially interesting, like, given that something that comes up between Avery and Millie this chapter is, like, how much Millie is willing to just judge, you know, the many for the crimes of the few, I suppose. I don't know. I think it's really interesting.
It's a great opening to that whole vibe of that's going to be in this chapter of like Millie's going to judge goblins forever after this. And part of the reason that she hates goblins is because the first time she saw them, two of them tried to kill her.
We jump forward in time and Millie is asking for residency at the BHI. Alexander asks her to justify herself, and despite presenting a multifaceted argument, he ends up rejecting her.
I miss this guy so much. Like, just seeing Alexander having coffee and tea with someone again, I was like, oh, I forgot how much fun this guy is as a villain.
Yeah, he's Alexander. Great, isn't he?
Yeah.
I love Alexander, I guess is just what I want to say. Like, comparing him to Bristow and Musa, one, he's just better. Like,
yeah.
The way he's talking about things like making sure that practitioner kids are more well-rounded is just so, I mean, I, unironically, I just completely agree with it, right?
Oh, yeah.
But also, he's just really fun.
I know, yeah. Just seeing him playing his games again, I was like, God, I miss this. Like,
miss him.
It's a shame somebody else couldn't die and he could still be kicking around. I mean, you're right,
that's
though.
His own fault, but yeah.
It is a shame. I love this vibe we have of Alexander where it's like he genuinely is like, I want to help people stop being so angry and like we can all come together and be better for it. And it's that top layer of his logic that you're actually like, oh, I can get on board with that. But if you poke too much into Alexander's logic, it's like he also then 2 minutes later is talking about Seth and just how he's not fixing Seth, and we know he's going to end up forswearing him. So it's a bit like, okay, so, you know, you want to make people better, but clearly you're fine with a few victims along the way.
Yes.
I mean, that was the thing with Alexander. There was some. He's the opposite of Verona in that there was some light in him, but he just lost it to his ambition and selfishness.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. God, he's so great, though. I love getting him. Yeah, getting more Alexander time is great.
But like here, like his entire lesson for Millie here is you're a good person and your family won't hate me if I do this to you, so you lose, which is very much like as much as he is talking about, oh, we all need to come together and be better. The real lesson he teaches her here that we're going to see her really take to heart is you're not cutthroat and good enough. Oh, so you're not cutthroat and evil enough that I need to worry about you.
Yes.
Which is, you know, as much as Alexander was trying to let everyone come together, he was far too willing to work with people who were pieces of shit.
Yeah, and that's Millie's appeal to him, right, is like, hey, if you want to change the system by kind of changing how practitioner families work, pick a good practitioner family, pick a practitioner family that tries to do good. That's what I am. And yeah, I mean, he turns her down. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Which
can't be too positive about him, I guess.
Directly contrasted by the decisions made by Kennet in the previous chapter.
Mm.
Like, you know, they want to make people better and they're trying to raise everyone up. But when they saw the monstrous stuff, Verona was like, well, we've got to shut that down. Like, Verona just did the opposite. She's making Toad Swallow re-earn his current position because of his dirty past. Whereas Alexander's like, sorry, but you're not scary enough for me to give you any ground. So I'm going to keep rewarding the people who are shitheads.
Mm. Yeah. Disappointing. Definitely. Oh, well. Millie speaks to her parents, who tell her that a fight is brewing at the BHI and ask her to pick one of the two militias to join. And she picks Bristow's.
So I don't know if that one came through. Millie-ishes.
Militias. Yeah.
You got to really hit that one. That one's sneaky. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
But this is really one of those turning points for Millie, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. Because, again, it's an extension of what she was just talking about in that she calls out to herself, okay, am I just picking Bristow because I know Alexander's a better person and won't be as problematic if we pick Bristow and he ends up, you know, and Alexander ends up winning. And then she decides to pick Bristow anyway. I don't know. Maybe you can read it as a marker of Millie recognizing and yet making the same choices that all the practitioners make. Or maybe you can think that it is still the better strategic option. I don't know, but it's just, it's just a problem. I don't know.
See, I saw it as Alexander's own bullshit coming to bite him in the ass. Because the lesson he taught her in that conversation was, you're not going to hold it against me. Your family is good. And this is basically her. She's like, I'm worried that Bristow is a worse person. And her dad's like, does that matter? And she thinks about it. It's like between her dad and the lesson Alexander taught her, she's like, yeah, fuck him.
The slippery slope that Millie is going down this chapter.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's the thing. This world has taken someone who did actually want to be good and just constantly taught her that she needs to do this shit.
Yeah.
So the only positive read here is just the part where it's like, suck shit, Alexander. Like, your own past is catching up with you.
Yes. Aziza makes a good point, which is she specifically steps out of the privacy circle to say it, to make sure that Alexander can hear this kind of
fuck you to him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we jump forward to the present. Millie is visiting an old church, and what was once a man lived there. He's no longer a man. He was a kind guy who sacrificed himself to stop an evil which has started to spread through him like a melanoma.
Oh, this guy, man. Like, what? Mm. It's just funny because where we're up to in this point in the chapter, you're like, oh, I'm worried that Millie's going to start going down a really bad path. And then she meets literally like the worst person because it's guy who did the right thing and is being eternally punished for it. Like, it's just, I think the moment we sort of got this guy's deal, I was like, oh, well, Millie's fucked now. There's no way she's going to do the right thing after seeing this guy.
Mm. Yeah, it's, yeah, exactly. I mean, like, not only has his life been fucked, but he has become so degraded. Like, you know, there's no, I mean, what Millie thinks is there's no nobility to it, right? She's getting disillusioned with the fact that she used to think of them it as having some kind of noble sacrifice vibes, but that's just so clearly not what has happened here.
And like, that sucks because this dude should be like hero worshipped.
Yes.
Like, he's literally given everything to stop an evil thing. Like, this is a dude who everyone else should have helped, who should have been enshrined as a real fucking champ. And they've left him alone in the basement of a church. It's fuck.
Yeah. And it really gives the, like, I mean, like, it really lends credence to how the world sees warders, right? Like, it's almost like janitorial vibes in the sense that it's like, or, you know, garbage people, like a job that is very important for our society to function, but has kind of, due to just the circumstances of it, has, you know, been seen as, or is seen as, this like lower, lesser class thing.
Yeah.
Despite how vitally important it is.
Yeah, like I mean, that's a crazy way, particularly with the janitorial example. It always pisses me off because it's like, what do you, like you don't want people, like, somebody's got to clean this shit, right? Like, you know, it's a necessary job, and it just,
and especially so, you know, now that we're in a pandemic, I suppose it really, like, the value of cleanliness has been so clearly demonstrated to everybody. And maybe this is stretching the metaphor a bit, but I think we can apply that to the general shittiness that exists in the practitioner world in this story and how it seems to be getting worse. And it's there seems to be a parallel to, okay, that means that this type of warding and protective and, like, preventing entropy and degradation type of work is even more important.
Oh, yeah, I very much get the vibe that if the Legendros decided they wanted to go all out and, like, cast morality to the wind, they could cause a lot of fucking damage on their way out.
Yes, which is kind of what Millie does in this chapter, right?
But, like, again, that's still, like, scratching the surface. That's doing one of these
100%,
things.
100%, yeah.
She could go back and get that church guy, and that's, like, potentially a whole weapon. Actually, sorry, we haven't yet talked about the moment where she actually hints that maybe the power is dissipated from the thing, but he's too
he's too far gone for that to for that exploration to even be a possibility.
Which again is just like that thing, like, he's sunk so much into this, like, it's another reason to scare Millie off from this life, in that it's presenting this perspective of, oh, and maybe even when the thing isn't a threat anymore, you'll still be stuck doing it for no reason.
Just this eternal curse.
Yeah, and so it's like, you know, like, she's getting all these signs that just, like, there's reasons not to do this, and their family is sitting on a lot of power. They kind of can leverage if they need to. It's just, like, what a hard line to walk.
Yeah.
And especially to not be appreciated fully. Like, It shouldn't be. They shouldn't be respected because they have these giant monsters they can fuck your shit up with. But also, that is something they can do. Like, it's weird that it's like they should just be given a lot of respect because this is their job. But then also, if I need to get really annoying about it, I could also say, and also you should respect them because they can turn this shit on you if they want. Like, it's crazy,
I mean,
to me.
That's not the reason you should respect them, but no, it's something to keep, like, in mind.
It's like, look, if that's the only reason you'll accept, then fine, I'll take what I can get. But, like, if you, if that's the reason you give them respect, you're an idiot too. But yeah.
Millie is leaving and she's approached by some malicious goblins seeking entry to her domain with an O. She turns them away before kind of breaking down in her car at just kind of the overwhelming responsibility and lack of respect of her position.
Yeah, because for her, goblins are just little pests, and the fact is that even they don't really respect her here. I do just, I want to call out, you said that she scares them away or turns them away. She does that, and then she also sends some shit to just, like, obliterate them.
Yes.
Like, you know, and I get why she's doing that, because she feels offended, but also, hey, maybe goblins aren't going to respect you if after they play you their really cool new instruments, you, like, break all their limbs.
Yeah. And it's pretty clear that these goblins are not of the same ilk that she encountered when she was younger, right? I don't know. I kind of was thinking, like, is that just because she is powerful now and therefore the goblins can't be? Like, I don't know. Goblins feel the scariest to innocents, you know? Like, the goblins are, maybe the goblins that we like are just the ones that we've known from the eyes of practitioners as opposed to the eyes of relative innocents or, like, less powerful people.
Well, I mean, you know, Blunt Munch in Arc 2 told us about going to make that dog, right? And then we saw the dog. Like, did some pretty fucked up shit outside of Kennet. I definitely, like, read this as, like, yeah, you know, like, goblins are goblins, right? They're all over the place. These are funny little goblins who build instruments in the wood. In the woods, like, just out of each other. Whereas, you know, those ones in the city, they were, like, the evil cutthroat serial killer goblins. And, like, I guess this is the thing, like, I mean, I'm struggling not to just call this out as a metaphor for racism because it's quite overt, but, like, she grew up in an environment that was teaching her that goblins were pests to be exterminated. She's had this really bad first initial impression of them, you can understand why she's so biased against them in a way that's really difficult to deprogram her on. I can understand how she has grown into a 16-year-old who's incredibly biased against goblins. I don't think that we're seeing a new side to goblins necessarily. I just think it's like we've seen the better sides in this story and Millie has seen the worst.
The worst sides, yeah. I want to pull out something that Singachi has said in chat because I think it's worth keeping in mind. This is like Millie has taken over this area in a kind of colonial takeover and then kicked the goblins out and destroyed them, right? Like,
yeah, true.
It really is pretty fucked up.
I mean, exactly. Like, it's that disconnect from the actual effects of her actions that's got her.
Yes. Yeah. Millie gets some reinforcements just in case anything goes down. And Millie takes them to check on one of the wardings for the Bjorgman.
and this is where America shows up. And I love how America sort of justifies her presence here by saying, A, she wouldn't be able to annoy Millie if she wasn't here. And also B, she liked Alexander's whole deal with the reaching out and staying connected. And even if that's you, I want to do it. And I just really, really love this because as much as America sucks, like we were just talking about, this was the good thing about Alexander. And I think in this particular example, America is somebody who has a lot to teach Millie. We were just talking about how Millie has grown up with this perception of like damning all goblins because there are bad ones. And America is a walking, talking example of how that's not really the case. So I'm actually like, you know, this is an example of the good Alexander did manage to do.
Yeah, definitely. And I think America is a great representation of that in this chapter, like a great piece of connective tissue.
It's great as well because America just fucking sucks, like just as a person. Like, you know, we saw that last chapter. Yeah. So it's like, it's just funny to me that there is a good side to America and we get to see it in little bits and pieces. But yeah, this is just one of those moments where even though I kind of think America's a jackass, I think she'd be really good for Millie. And I'm glad that Alexander somehow managed to get them talking.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we'll help bridge the gap between the Kenneteers and the Musso crew, potentially. I don't know. Well, it seems less likely given the way this chapter ends.
Yeah.
I love how scary the Bjorgman is, like the build up to this warding, such a monstrous other. And then also, so that's great setup for when it gets turned against Avery later, which I think is wonderful. But also thinking about it, the Bjorgman's MO is just like the exact same thing that Thea did. So practitioners are so hypocritical.
That's a really good point. I mean, the Bjorgman does it on a much greater scale, I suppose. I think
I don't know.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I think the practitioner argument would be Thea does it in a sustainable way. She farms children sustainably.
Sure.
Yeah. But like, you know, you're right. It's a good point. They're both just kidnapping children, and it's pretty fucked up that Thea was so accepted in how well she did that. But yeah, fuck, we've got to talk about just how fucking scary the Bjorgman setup is. Like,
yes, I know.
It's weird because I kind of get the impression he is potentially one of the most powerful others we've seen in the story. And yet, like, he's just some dude who takes kids. And that somehow makes, like, my inability to make those two facts align in my head kind of it makes him seem even more off-putting. Because it's like, how is he someone sealers need to come and are so scared of when, you know, you would think, like, some of the shit we saw in the Carmine contest should be more scary and the stuff they're really dealing with.
I think part of it comes down to the fact that the Bjorgman feels like he can take kids from anywhere. Like, no practitioner could defend themselves against the Bjorgman if he was really set on it. You know what I mean? And I think that's right. What is the scariest thing to practitioners is not how violent or dangerous monsters are, but how little you can protect against them. Because really, being a practitioner is turning the system in your favor, right? So it makes me feel like the reason practitioners are scared of him and the reason why the Bjorgen is so powerful is because they're on a level playing field with everybody else.
Yeah, I just think that's interesting because, you know, like we saw a bunch of these Unchained, like the horror thing and the girl with the other that had the splinter in it and the Carmine contest and all that stuff. And that's like that wasn't stuff that was getting this same level of attention from Sealers.
Yeah.
So that like that just said a lot about the Bjorgmen to me. And when you think about like just what we've seen in this story with things like that horror, like the Bjorgmen, we've got that demon that's bound that's like the 7919 thing, you know, with the people who get the tattoos and when it reaches that number. And there's just this real sense building up that the entire world of the Otherverse is really founded on just a few small practitioners who are actually doing their fucking job and binding things like that. And the rest of the people are just fucking around and ruining it for the rest of us.
Yeah, 100%.
And Millie's about to go from one camp to the other.
Yeah, which is pretty sad. So yeah, Millie's territory gets invaded and the Bjorgmen wants to make a deal. Let them free, Millie. Hey, so do you think the Bjorgmen was like, the first deal that Bjorgmen offers is, I'll steal one child from your enemies. Do you think every steal counts as a child? Because that would have been pretty fucking terrifying.
I did worry about that when it first happened, but I think I got the vibe we're more talking like 9-year-olds.
Like your stuff. Carries.
Like, you know, like, yeah, it would take Declan or Kerry, but not Avery, which, you know, we should hear him out.
Yeah,
I don't know. Like, it's, I get like, okay, so the thing that really freaks me out about the Bjorgmen is that the kids, we're going to get some kids back soon, and they're just seemingly fine, and also they haven't aged, and that's somehow more scary to me that, like, I assume he's eating them. Like, when he first came up, I was like, oh, he must eat them to get power. If he's able to just give them back as they were and they're undamaged, what is he... Like, I don't understand him mechanically, and that makes him more terrifying. You know what I mean?
I can imagine, like, sealing children away and then using them as kind of, like, perpetual batteries, you know, not... More like Matrix-esque than eat like a vampire.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, but that's existentially horrifying.
Yes, like, true.
I don't know. I'm also surprised that that works for him. Like, usually, you know, I feel like you've got, like, people in this world, you know, working with the milkmaid to stay young. Meanwhile, this dude, you know, you can just get it for free.
Yeah. Yeah, true. the spanner that the Bjorgmen throws of revealing that Hugh has taken a deal previously to get rid of giving up Cabe in exchange for sealing the Bjorgmen away again. So good. What a fucking payoff.
Yeah, especially because I think this is like, this is the final straw in that. I think the one scrap Millie had held on to at this point was this idea that her family had their honor because they didn't use these things.
Yes, yes. And they had a kind of purity of morality.
Yeah, and like the one good thing about the family and the job was that sense of, you know, at least we don't abuse it. And now Millie is learning that actually that's not true. And like,
well,
because you know this. Well, I was going to say, you know that this is not the only time Hugh's done this with one.
Oh, you think?
Yeah.
I don't know. To be fair, Hugh's trade-off here is giving up Cabe to, in exchange for the Bjorgmen not being free. So the Bjorgmen let himself be bound. So he was breaking out. Reinforcements were coming. Hugh gave up Cabe to kind of placate the Bjorgmen so that he could be rebound, right?
Yeah.
Which is much better than using the Bjorgmen against your enemies as Millie does. Like, Millie jumps way past what her dad did, in my opinion.
Well, she uses him under the proviso that he can't take any kids and he gives three up. I mean, she's but set also, up on what is... Yeah. He's very open about it being a slippery slope he's putting her on.
I also feel like, though, the fact that he's like, I will wait to be rebound, but no more than 50 years. Like, I think the Bjorgman is kind of counting on the fact that Millie's not going to be able to rebind him.
Oh yeah, I was thinking that as well. She ends the scene captured by Basil, and I was just saying, it's like, okay, so hold on. We are going to let her out for a day to go rebind him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, like the real moment of this Cable Legendary stuff is just very much like shattering the last thing I think Millie was holding on to, which was any sense that the family as a wider whole had honor for the job it was doing. Because, no, they have been using these things.
Yeah, or at least dealing with them.
Yeah. And Millie thinks to herself here, when it accuses her of being weak of character, she's like, oh, I don't think I'm weak of character. And it's like, it's probably about
prove yourself a minute. Wrong, Millie.
Yeah, it's been a minute after that that she like makes the deal. That between her and Basil, Gilkey's really covering the post summer break interludes for not being a piece of shit.
Yeah,
because Basil was just as self unaware as Millie is right here.
Yeah. Avery and Anne arrive ready to take Millie into their custody. She knows she is beaten, but rather let herself be taken. She lets herself become even more compromised, releasing the Bjorgman, and she and her crew escape in the chaos.
It's really cool getting to see Anne from someone else's perspective in a fight like this, because it seems like Anne's actually kind of boss. Like, she's got like a custom rigged Abyss plus Ruins practice that is like usually something you do in either or, is the vibe that Millie gives, and she somehow jerry-rigged it so she gets both. And so like she's walking around with like her cool self-invented custom rig and shit. And it was like, oh wow, so when she's not being a dickhead at like HOA meetings, she's actually cool as hell.
Yeah, when she's doing what she's here to do, she's kind of fun.
Yeah, it was just nice to get to see her from that other side, because it's so easy to write her off as just, you know, Anne and Deb are the dickheads of the...
Council.
The dickhead kiss-asses of Thunder Bay. But when you take them out of that environment, it seems like Anne's actually kind of impressive.
Yeah. It's great stuff. I do love seeing Anne in action, as it were.
Yeah. Millie lets the Bjorgman out, like, really selling the idea that he's right, that she's just going to give in eventually.
Yep.
And I mean, like, I love, this seems like a good spot to talk about sort of like the arc as a whole. Cause like arc 16, I do think there will be more next week, but arc 16 really established itself at the start as this is the arc where we're going to think about how to rebuild after the loss. Like 14 and 15 were the arcs where they just recovered from the loss. Arc 16 established, this is the arc where we start to rebuild. And specifically, I think the whole arc has been talking about like what you'll build, like thinking about what you're building and who you build it with. And like Verona obviously addressed that quite head on in the first chapter we talked about today. But I love how Millie's interlude here is a fascinating deep dive into a system where when you don't think about that, it's doomed to fail. Like Millie is a person who, when we started this chapter, she was someone who wanted to do the right thing. And in the process of like 6 years, she's now become somebody who lets a guy who's a child stealer out. Like she and her family associated with the worst sort of person. And in the end, it kind of corrupted them.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. This is a direct onward effect of her siding with Bristow over Alexander, right?
Yeah, like I love how this chapter stands kind of towards the end of this arc as a sort of thing justifying what we've been talking about this arc. Like it's sort of saying, and if you don't give people incentives to be good, and if you let them associate with the worst kinds of people and don't punish them for it, you end up with Millies, the good young people who just won't end up being good.
Yeah. We get to see it in action. Get to see that slippery slope happening in this very chapter, which is good stuff. God, I love the Bjorgman. The Bjorgman. I don't know. Do you think we're going to get to see the fight between Avery and Bjorgman next chapter? I don't know, but yeah, it's going to be fun stuff.
Yeah, I wouldn't put my money on it, but you know, this is one of those I hope I'm wrong sort of moments. Yeah,
I would like to see it. I also love Otis's cab just showing up and being like, hey, you want a lift? Like, it's not the world's most sus thing. And what's even worse is it almost fucking works.
That was the thing I didn't understand. Oh my God, I was like, aren't you guys in the middle of fucking nowhere? And then this cab just shows up and it's like, hey, get in.
Well, they were on a road that they'd been walking along. So, I mean, it kind of was possible, but very strange.
No. But, like, you know, a road in, like, country, like, obviously, I think rural Canada is fairly similar to regional Australia. So I feel pretty confident saying if you're walking on one of those roads, you can just not expect to see a car for 2 days. Like, yes, let alone a cab. Like, the town I just moved away from had two cabs that operate from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. Like, cabs just aren't a thing in the region. It's like that. That, like, between towns, it's unheard of that you just find a cab that's free. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it was, like, pretty funny.
Like, these are so clearly city kids that they even thought about it for a second.
Well, Sullivan even says that he's never been in a cab, so.
That's one of those great little Wild Bo details, like, just to remind us that the Musses are so, like, rich kids, like, because that's one of those things that I would never have thought about, like, rich people not having done, but, like, you know, like, for a rich person, it might be a novelty to get to take a cab, as opposed to having your private driver drive you around. I assume that's how it works for the Musters.
Yes, one would assume, for sure. But so, yeah, Millie and her crew rest and recuperate safely a few territories over, except it's not as safe as it appears. We're in Bridge's territory here, and Bridge makes his move.
One of the funny things that jumped out to me the second time I was reading this was this segment opens with Millie's family and some others arguing over what to do about the fact that all these territories have been taken. And one of them says, we need a system. We need passcodes to secure against something like doppelgangers or glamour. And reading this the second time, I was like, that would have been a great idea a couple of weeks ago, bud.
Yep. Yeah. What a great end to a chapter this is, huh? Like, setting up what the next conflict is going to be, setting up that we're about to have what seems like we're going to move into the showdown with the Musses. Yeah, I'm just really excited.
Yeah, because, wait, that's the thing, is I very much have the understanding that Musa won't care and probably even anticipated losing a handful of territories on this side of Ontario.
Yes.
Because the idea being if he gets Toronto, which he did, the rest of them will presumably fall. So it's kind of like, I mean, I'm almost more interested at this point to see what Kennett has up their sleeves, because this has to have been anticipated by Musser, at the very least, something that he'll just, like, roll his eyes about and just undo. So what's their plan?
I want to see what Charles is planning, because we still have no idea what Charles is planning to do to deal with this Musser stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I'm eager for that. But yeah, we'll have to see that next time.
Yeah. I think we'll be back next week for a little bit more Arc 16 and then maybe some Arc 17.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
But before we wrap up this episode, Elliot, of course, time to look at some predictions that our community has left in the Pale Predictor form that's linked in the show notes down below. Do you want to pull yours out first, Elliot?
Yeah, sure. I've got a prediction from Fairlax. Who basically is predicting that by the end of the story, Cherry Pop will have amounted to something.
don't buy it.
Basically, they specifically predict that she'll develop some kind of goblin ability to, like, bring people down to her level. So basically the idea that if you argue with Cherry and, like, try to engage with her, you get dragged down and become temporarily stupider and people will ignore you. Specifically, Fairlax compares her to a reverse Sphinx, where, like, she, by giving you questions, she just makes you dumber.
I do love that.
I mostly pulled out this prediction because I don't know if I agree with it or not, but it just made me realize there has not been enough where Cherry Pop will be at the end of the story discourse, and we really need to fix that, gang. Like, this is a character who we need to, you know, really speculate on where they'll be by the epilogues.
Fair enough. I mean, I'm assuming we'll get like 3 or 4 Cherry Pop epilogues. Chepilogues. So I've put out a prediction by Idan Dor, and this is a prediction that's very wild, but I really like it. I really, really like it. So basically, here's the prediction. Verona is responsible in the trio for getting rid of Charles so that they can replace him. And the way that she's going to do that is by intentionally using her domain to bridge the paths and Kennet to bring the wolf into Kennet to kill Charles. That's pretty insane. But there's some interesting things to it. So really, there's not evidence for it specifically, but there is evidence that Idandor points out that Verona's up to something with her domain, right? Like she talks about a few times, she talks about things like in her diagram, she'd added the ones she'd illustrated for the Kennet to come. And then she thinks, she wondered if Charles would see, notice, and put it together. Like there are a few lines like that that don't quite make sense, like because they've already cleared what they're doing with Charles and the crew, the fact they're getting a domain and the fact there's a third Kennet. Like there's
I had wondered about that
track, right? Unless she's planning on using her domain for something, and Idandor speculates it's to bring in the wolf to murder Charles. And again, it's a wild theory. It's very out there, but I just really like it. So I thought I'd bring it up.
I was kind of working off the impression it was a little more something to do with the nature of Lost Kennet or something itself.
Yes, but which it could be.
I remember getting a lot of predictions from people during like Arc 12 and maybe early Arc 13 about the wolf winning the Carmine contest. Like a lot of people feel like the wolf is not just a big presence in the story. Like we've talked about that a lot, but somebody who is kind of weirdly powerful. So she keeps slotting into people's Carmine related predictions because she's so powerful. And this is one of the first ones where I'm like, oh, I can see that. Like rather than the wolf being used to win the Carmine contest, which never felt right, learning that Verona was planning to tap her to fight Charles, I'm like, oh, I can see that. Like, so yeah, I could see this. I could see this. I mean, the wolf will be coming back into the story. There's no doubt.
Yes, I'm sure there'll be another wolf.
Yeah. Encounter. So it's a question of, is this it?
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll have to see. But that's the end of our episode. Actually, we should talk about the discussion question. We were going to be reviewing discussion question answers today, but because this is quite an early episode and people are still kind of theory crafting about the Pisces and Hazel stuff, we thought we would leave this one for one more week just to give people time to reflect their thoughts on it. I saw in the subreddit, Snowdrop's Tiny Fan had posted a really good breakdown of what they thought the Pisces and Hazel stuff was about. So we're giving that a bit more time to kind of, you know, percolate in people's minds before we get back to it.
Yeah, I really liked her theory. It's probably like jumped right up to being one of my favorites, in terms of how much I think it could be it. But
I think the part that doesn't that I'm still curious about is how Avery broke into the paths based on what STF said. But anyway, I do recommend everyone go and check out her Reddit post on the subject because I think it was very, very interesting.
Yeah. Exactly. But if we wanted to cover it today, like we just wouldn't have done any of the answers justice. And this is a discussion question I want to give a lot of justice to because people've got really good answers. So we'll do it next week. So an extra week of tinfoiling for everyone.
Yeah. But that's the end of our show then, Elliot. If you want to leave your answers to that discussion question, you can leave them in the show in the discussion thread, which is linked in the show notes down below.
You can also check out our Twitter at Power Reflect Cast. We've taken that back from Cherry Pop. She had a week of posting memes. It didn't go over well. They weren't that popular in the end, but that's Cherry Pop in a nutshell.
That's classic Cherry Pop, yeah. If you want to support this show or any of the other shows on the network, well, first of all, the network, what's that? You can find out more by going to doofmedia.com.
Don't forget to stop by our Patreon, patreon.com/doofmedia. That's how you can support the network that you've been reading all about on doofmedia.com.
Yes, and of course, while you're at Patreon, remember to stop by Wildbo's Patreon and support Wildbo in creating these wonderful stories that we get to experience at patreon.com/wildbo.
Yeah, Because, you know, if you're not rewarding him for writing this good story, then he's going to turn around like Millie and write bad and stories.
Unleash bad stories on us. Let down the sacred wards that reveal that he's got a folder full of.
He'll forswear Verona like slash what we were talking about.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, catch you around, folks. See you next time. Bye.